Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes consolidated into three oral arguments on its oral docket. In the order of the presentation, they are as follows. City of Fort Worth versus Julius Zimlick from Travis County. University of Houston and others versus Demetria Clark from Harris County, consolidated with Stephen Gary Erner and Harris County versus Francis G. Thomas and John Alexander Rourke, also from Harris County. And N. Ray John McFarlane, an original mandamus proceeding. The court has allotted 25 minutes for each side to make oral argument in the consolidated cases and 20 minutes for each side in the other cases. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and conclude the arguments by lunch. The clerk is recording these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of the arguments for a nominal fee. Justice Owen is ill today, but she will participate in the deliberation and decision in these cases. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in City of Fort Worth versus Zimlick.
May it please the court, Ms. Ann Clark Snell and Ms. Amy Ward will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Snell will open with the first 15 minutes. Ms. Ward will present rebuttal.
May it please the court. The question presented today in this case is whether to grant life tenure plus entitlement to promotion and a choice of assignment to an employee who reports a violation of law. We'd like to discuss with the court today two things, causation and punitive damages. With regard to causation, the issue is whether to stop using time, which protects the employer from liability for bad motives never acted upon, or whether to adopt a collective causation standard, which does not. With regard to punitive damages, the issue is whether to move away from Continental Coffee and no longer require malice plus proof of something more than the underlying tort. Agency analysis is also essential. It's a central part of each of these issues, causation and punitive damages. Employers act through their agents. The conduct and the intent of the ultimate decision maker must be analyzed to determine the causal connection between the conduct in the report and the conduct of the employer after the report. The conduct and the intent of the ultimate decision maker must also be analyzed, not only for causal connection, but also to show that this ultimate decision maker acted with malice, that is, we all know what malice is, spiteful, out of a grudge, with regard to something more than the underlying tort. These charts answer questions about causation and malice regarding ultimate decision makers and give you some idea of what happened in code enforcement over here in the green chart and what happened in the marshal's office after Mr. Zimlick transferred back to the marshal's office in 1994.
Now, you note on here that there's no evidence of retaliatory intent by Donahoe. What about the statement, how much more retaliatory intent can you get than the statement, you're lucky to have a job after this incident?
We think you have to look at the context, Your Honor. In this case, we think that's not probative evidence of intent because there's no evidence whatsoever that Mr. Donahoe ever disapproved of the report. In fact, he encouraged it. In fact, that he knew about it. We don't think knowledge, Your Honor, is intent.
But isn't that weighing the evidence? Aren't you weighing the credibility of the evidence?
Well, there's not a case out there, Your Honor, that says it's sufficient to have a comment like that be the causal connection, and that is what we argue, that that statement stands alone is not sufficient to infer malice.
No evidence.
It's no evidence.
What about that statement, though, in connection with the other evidence that the Court of Appeals outlined? the fact that he was given a, for example, the fact that he was given a position for which he was overqualified in accordance with the city's practice of who should do that particular job. Why isn't that enough evidence that a jury can make the decision about whether or not these employment decisions were retaliatory?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, we don't agree that he was overqualified for this position.
Well,
I mean,
didn't he put some evidence? I know that you don't agree with that,
yes.
But since we're doing a no evidence review, isn't there evidence in the record to that effect?
No, we would say not, Your Honor. What the evidence is in this case, under Hines, must be analyzed altogether, including what was put on for the legitimate reason. And the legitimate reason was they were reorganizing the department, and that was always a routine assignment.
Well, I understand that, but didn't he put on evidence? Isn't there evidence in the record that disputes that?
I don't think it does, Your Honor.
No, I'm not asking if you think it does. Isn't there evidence in the record to that effect?
No, it's our intent that that is not evidence in the record.
There's nothing in the record that shows that this post was ordinarily filled by rookies or retirees wanting an extra paycheck.
No. The evidence shows that, in fact, this was a rotating job. It was fairly new in the department. It was put into the department after a judge and several lawyers were killed in the courthouse.
So do you disagree with the Court of Appeals recitation of what it found in the record?
We do, Your Honor.
And you say that that's not in the record?
We say it's not in the record in the way that the court reports it.
Well,
and that
I'm not sure I understand that. Maybe, are you disagreeing with the Court of Appeals as to the probative effect of the evidence, or are you disagreeing that this evidence is in the record at all anywhere, that we will find a question and an answer to that effect? Which is your position?
Our position is that that the record does not have any probative evidence, an opinion, yes, by two deputies, that that's what they thought of the position. We also know that Deputy Zimlick did not like the position. But there is no evidence in this record that it was ever used to punish anybody or that any retiree ever held it.
I just want to make sure I understand your position. I understand that you don't think that this rises to the level of no evidence. But the Court of Appeals has a list of about 8 things in the opinion at pages 406 and 407, which it says is evidence. Separate and apart from any disagreement you have with the Court of Appeals about the legal test that was applied or the probative effect of that evidence, is this a correct recitation? Will we find in the evidence that there is a question and an answer regarding whether or not Zimlich was ordered to sit at the courthouse medical tent?
No, he was on the metal detectors for 8 months. That's absolutely correct.
All right, and so this recitation of facts is correct in the opinion. It's just that you don't think it has sufficient probative effect to meet the Hines test.
That's right. Okay.
Thank you.
The ultimate decision makers in this case were Marshall Donahoe and Elsa Paniagua, who was the director of municipal court. Donahoe assigned Zimlich to courthouse security for 8 months on the metal detectors. Paniagua promoted Zimlich to senior deputy, but 4 or 5 months later did not promote him to chief deputy. The report was made by Zimlich when he was working in the code enforcement division, and it was about supervisors and code enforcement. The alleged retaliatory act all occurred after he came back to the marshal's office and after he transferred out of code enforcement. The marshal's office had nothing to do with code enforcement. There was absolutely no line of authority between the two. The case is under the whistleblower statute before it was amended. The legislature sometimes does not require proof of discrimination or proof of intent. In fact, in the Whistleblower Act, there's a 90-day rebuttable presumption that if the action, the conduct that the employee complains of, happened within 90 days of the report, then it will be presumed. You may rebut that presumption. But Hines said...
Do you agree that was the case in these circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor. If it happened within 90 days, you could certainly...
Even if one even if Davis was the author of the report and Donahoe was the actor taking the disciplinary action?
It would be a presumption that, yes, Your Honor, I don't think the statute makes any difference between the actors, the statute itself. However, I do think that with regard to Donahoe, you're still going to have to look at causation. You're still going to have to look at what the evidence says. You're still going to have to look, as Hines requires us, at whether this action would have happened when it did, but for the report.
But you think there's a presumption if it's within 90 days?
Yes. If there
is... In what sense does that make?
In what difference does that make?
No, I said, what sense does that make? To have a presumption that if the report and the actor are a long way apart in the organization, but it's within a certain period of time, there's a presumption that the two are related. But if it's after 90 days, your contention is not only is it not related, it can't be related, basically.
Well, it can be related, of course. You can prove causal connection. That's what Hines is all about. That's what we're trying to articulate. I think this is a difficult issue. All the courts have struggled with what kind of evidence is sufficient to show a causal connection in a retaliatory employment case like this. And punitive damages have troubled this court for at least 12 years. I think these are difficult issues, but I do think the legislature said there's a presumption that if a person has adverse employment action taken against them within 90 days after the report, that the reason for the conduct of the employer was retaliation.
What more would it take in the facts of this case, as you see them, for there to be liability for whistleblowing?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, I think it was rebutted, that presumption. So I don't think
But what more would it take? What evidence could there be that would make Fort Worth liable for Donahoe's actions?
There would have to be, thank you, I didn't understand the question, Your Honor. You'd have to be something that allowed you to link or connect the action of Donahoe with what happened in code enforcement. And there is nothing like that. There's no, if you look at Shager, Judge Posner's opinion, there has to be something like a recommendation that Donahoe acted upon, or some information that was conveyed to him by someone who had a retaliatory intent, and he acted on it without giving it any thought, without looking into it, or so on. In this case, there was no need for Donahoe to do an investigation. He's the person who knew Zimlick most. Zimlick had worked for him for 4 years. And when Zimlick came and talked to him, merely because of their relationship, and told him, I'm going to make a report, Donahoe said, well, go ahead and do that. And he said, I think they're interfering with my investigation. He said, keep investigating. So under these facts, Your Honor.
But what more does he need to say than to say to Mr. Zimlick, you're lucky you have this job after he comes back? Why isn't that some evidence that he acted as the conduit of what had happened over in the other section of the city's offices?
Because, Your Honor, that statement is on its face ambiguous. It could mean
doesn't a jury get to resolve that? Isn't that what you argue to a jury? We think that you should interpret this statement to mean this?
It has to be a reasonable inference that you're making in light of the fact that Donahoe testified, Zimlick testified, Astorga testified, that there was never any disapproval of the report whatsoever. One cannot assume that if after Zimlick came and complained to him a lot, he said, look, you're lucky to even have a job after that.
To follow up further on what Justice Heck is asking about, on what evidence it would be required, is it your position that as the Court of Appeals said in its opinion, they said that your argument was that these were two separate divisions of the city's function, almost like there was a wall in between.
Right.
And because you had the bad conduct reported as to one division and the later employment decision made in another, that was sufficient to break the causal link. Is it your position then that is always the case?
Not always, Your Honor. If, as I said to Justice Heck, if you're able to show some connection, if, for instance,
you have to have direct evidence and have an admission from someone, is that what you're saying you have to
there have? There has to be substantive evidence that shows that Davis said something to Donahoe or gave something to Donahoe that made Donahoe act as he did, and that Donahoe was a willing or ignorant and innocent conduit of the retaliatory intent of someone else. It so, cannot be presumed.
So what you're saying then is that if Davis had falsified an evaluation of Zimley's performance, and that goes into Zimley's personnel file, and then Zimley transfers to another division, and his new supervisor, in making decisions about promotion, relies upon that falsified evaluation without any prior knowledge of the past bad history, that there would be liability to the city in that case?
Yes, yes, Your Honor, I think it would be. I think if there's a bad report, and you rely on that bad report, and that bad report was made out of a retaliatory intent, then you are acting as if you were the retaliator. You are not in any way exercising your discretion to look into the matter. In this same period that we're talking about here, when Zimlet was assigned to the metal detectors, he was depressed.
Aren't you weighing the evidence? I mean, all this was before the jury as to animus and all these different things, and they were able to observe the credibility of all these witnesses and determine what the intent and effect of those statements were. It sounds like every time we mention evidence, you mention other evidence, and we're weighing the evidence.
No, I'm sorry. I don't intend for you to weigh the evidence. I'm intending to say that if there's a report, I was trying to distinguish between...
There were written statements that he was badge heavy and other statements like that. Is it just that it wasn't in his file? I mean, clearly Donahoe was aware of these statements.
There's not a statement that he was badge heavy anywhere. That is absolutely inaccurate. That is not in there. And in fact...
I don't mean a written statement.
That wasn't in Davis's report to the city council?
It was not, Your Honor. Zimlick is never mentioned in Davis's report to the city council. If you look at Davis' report to the city council, you're going to have to interpret that the same way as you would any other written statement within its four corners.
But weren't there statements made that he was badge heavy and other statements like that that were communicated to Donahoe? I don't remember how.
Not that I'm aware of. I may not recall that.
Did the Court of Appeals miscite that?
Yes, it did.
There is no such statement in the record.
There is no such statement in the
record.
All
right, I know your time's up. Let me just ask you one more quick question. Under your version of the Hines test, where you have to show retaliatory animus on the actor, what would prevent a city who does have, or a department that does have retaliatory intent, from just transferring the employee to another department and sort of getting around? I mean, how would you ever prove the crossover between departments of a retaliatory intent? Wouldn't it be very difficult, if not impossible, to prove?
I don't think so. If there's a reason for your action that has nothing to do with this past conduct and this past report, you can explain that as an employer. I think that's what Hines said. That has to be given credence unless you can show that that's false, that that's not true. There's not one thing in this thing that shows anything that was said was false. People said different things, but not that what the employer said was false.
But couldn't they find it was pretextual, that it was just an excuse?
Not unless there's something to show it was pretextual, other than they're just deciding they're going to disregard it. That's what Hines says. Hines says, you have got to look at that, and you cannot. This Court of Appeals didn't talk about it at all. Your Honor, we think that the decision...
Well, the Court of Appeals didn't finish your sentence. The Court of Appeals didn't talk about what? You were in the middle of answering that question.
The Court of Appeals did not talk about the reasons given by the city.
But why would they if they're doing a legal sufficiency review?
Given
the standard of review, aren't we looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict?
Ironically, this same Court of Appeals just last month decided a case in which they used the right causation standard.
I'm a little bit confused about why we would be looking at the city's evidence to determine if there was more than a scintilla of evidence to support the verdict.
Because you cannot punish an employer for bad motives never acted upon. If you show bad motives all over the place and they're not connected to the actor, then you cannot hold the city liable for those bad motives.
Well, are you asking us to change the standard of review in these kinds of cases when we conduct legal sufficiency review?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I'm just saying that the review has to be consistent with what Hines says. which says that you have to look at the legitimate reasons. You've got to make sure that they're not sufficient, unrebutted, legally sufficient, legitimate reasons for that employer's action. And we think that is not the way the evidence is presented in this case.
Any other questions? Thank you, Hilton. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Doug Alexander will present argument for the respondent.
Your Honors, in the brief time I have, I intend to do two things. One, to clarify what our position is with respect to the legal standard of causation, and two, to go into some of the factual matters that have been discussed. First, turning to the legal standard, there are some rhetorical questions that were presented at the beginning. Our position is not that we're in favor of life tenure. We don't advocate this court stop using Hines. We don't adhere to any notion of collective causation in the sense that it is being used. What we are saying here is that this is a causation case. Hines makes that clear. And the question is there evidence of an unsevered causal link between the protected activity and the ultimate adverse employment consequence?
The pervasive problem, though, is the life tenure aspect. And that is that whenever an employee reports something that may give rise to this type of situation, if that employee is fired, that employee almost automatically is going to have a lawsuit unless the employee was fired for something egregious for which a tenured professor could be fired, such as killing somebody else in the workplace or something egregious like that. Why would there not be the inference that could be drawn whenever a report has been made and then whenever subsequent to that, that person is fired? Why could a report, I mean, why could the inference not be drawn that the reason for it was because of making the report?
Well, because you have to demonstrate it. You have to prove the causal link. You have to have substantial evidence of it.
Is that
in any case.
Is that enough?
What is that?
Is that enough to get to the jury, the fact that it was a report and then followed by disciplinary action?
No. It is not enough to get to the jury.
Suppose a fellow walks up to the manager, walks up to the supervisor and says, well, it's your call. But if it were me, I'd fire Jones for making a comp claim. Is that, and then it, 2 months later, Jones is demoted. Is that enough evidence to show retaliatory discharge?
Not unless you can show it was acted upon. If you can show that it was acted upon, yes. If you can't, no. In other words, you have to have the causal link. And there's no question about that. This is what they keep saying, is that basically to establish the causal link, you have to demonstrate. I mean, look at their chart. They suggest that you have to prove that the person who took the ultimate action, him or herself, had malice. And you don't have to do that.
But to the contrary, you have to have purity among every employee of the institution. If you have, let's say, 100 employees, what if you have two or three saying, you know, that bum should be fired for doing this? But those are just people who work there. They have no ability to make the decision. And the decision maker decides, well, we're going to fire him, but for some other reason. Because these other employees at the company made those comments, you get to a jury, the jury finds that way, you're stuck.
No, you're not. Not unless you can come forward with a type of evidence that's been recognized that will draw that causal link. I must say this, the jurisprudence in this state has not really developed what type of evidence that you can look for to establish that.
Looking at what has been harped on here on page 406 of the CA opinion, at head note 6, I don't understand how that amounts to sufficient evidence.
Tell me what head note 6 says.
If we believe the evidence permits a reasonable inference that but for Zimlet's protected activity, he would not have suffered the discrimination found by the jury. And then they detail items 1 through 8.
Okay.
How does that demonstrate the causal connection?
Well, let's break them down. Let's start with a question, and let's turn now just to the evidence itself. First, the statement. Direct question placed to Donahoe. Why are we still here after a month when no one has ever been assigned to this position on more than a relief basis? Answer, you're just lucky to have a job after the Peters incident. Now, what does Shager tell us? Judge Posner says it is up to the jury to disambiguate ambiguities. Our position is that's not ambiguous at all. Donahoe has just told him why he's there. Number two, the fact that there has never been an experienced officer that has been placed at this position before this. Look at the, and that the other fellow officers plainly understand that this is punitive in nature. They've always considered it that way. Look at Judge Edith Jones' decision in the Forsyth case. That was a situation in which people blew the whistle, pointed to illegal wiretapping, and they were busted down. It was a transfer. No change in pay. They were transferred from the intelligence unit to uniform night patrol, which everybody understood was effectively a demotion. Under those circumstances, Judge Jones, with little more than that, said we have substantial evidence of it. $125,000 in actual damages is awarded, $750,000 in punitives. One thing you need to understand that's critically important, look at the Rhodes decision that's cited in our brief. It's by the Fifth Circuit. It's an in-bank decision. This is what it says. Because direct evidence is rare in discrimination cases, a plaintiff must ordinarily use circumstantial evidence to satisfy her burden of persuasion. Thus, this circuit has held repeatedly that a plaintiff need not provide direct evidence to sustain a jury finding of discrimination. The only time you have direct evidence is when someone says, I am doing this bad thing to you because you blew the whistle. That doesn't happen. So we look at quality of circumstantial evidence that would do it. Let's cite another one. In this case,
Hold on a second. You say we look at the quality of the circumstantial evidence.
Correct.
Why wouldn't that forever, always be a fact issue? You say, how can we, as a matter of law, look at the quality of the circumstantial evidence, weigh that circumstantial evidence, and say, as a matter of law, X should win or Y should win?
Well, I might have put that forward. We look at types of circumstantial evidence that have been relied upon by other courts as guidance to try to ferret out whether this individual has suffered from blowing the whistle. I'll give you another example. This is the Fifth Circuit again, with respect to pretext. The Fifth Circuit's in the Walter case, a decision by Judge Higginbotham says, a plaintiff may demonstrate pretext either by showing that a discriminatory motive more likely motivated employer, or that the employer's explanation is not worthy of credence. Now, why would we do that? If at trial...
Hold on a second, because there again we have a problem. Are you saying that the test would be whether or not the employer's explanation is worthy of credence?
That's what the Fifth Circuit has said, and I don't...
Do you agree or disagree with that?
I agree with that.
If that's the test, why would that not always be a fact issue? You always have to submit to the jury determine whether or not the employer's explanation is worthy of credence.
Okay. Subtle point. It's a subtle point. It's not simply enough, and Fifth Circuit courts have said this. You can't merely come in and say, this is not worthy of credence. You cannot attack that in a conclusory way. You have to come forward with evidence as the plaintiff to demonstrate that it's not worthy of credence. There is a difference. In other words, you cannot just baldly say, these people are liars. You can't believe that. You have to come forward with evidence. What is the evidence here? Just to get this will illustrate the point. One explanation that is given is, I was concerned about it. And the reason we do this is, if you come forward with an explanation not worthy of credence, it shows that you're trying to cover yourself for litigation. And that's what the Fifth Circuit has said. Here, I was concerned, Lana Ho says, that he was on medication. Well, Astorga, his partner, is also stuck there. No medication. Probably the more significant one is they trumped up this whole incredibly elaborate discussion about, I was concerned about his emotional stability because he was going through a traumatic child custody battle. And it went on and on and on. This is in the direct of Donahoe by the city. What was the true facts? On cross the next day, they come out with, here's the divorce decree. Here's the divorce decree. Does that refresh your recollection, Mr. Donahoe, Marshall Donahoe, that the custody battle was over 2 years before? Yeah. Redirect, city, no questions, Your Honor. Utterly pretextual. It fits under the Fifth Circuit standard. The evidence, the quality of evidence that has been recited by the Court of Appeals in this case would absolutely pass muster in the Fifth Circuit under the types of evidence that they have focused on. No question about it.
Well, let me ask you a question, Mr. Alexander. The
what is Zimlich suing over? Is he suing over the the assignment to the courthouse?
He's suing over
security.
He's suing over two things.
Okay.
One, assignment to the courthouse. Two, passed over for chief deputy.
What if I senior deputy claim? Besides the fact that
the senior deputy, they're trying to cite some bolstering evidence that there was no discriminatory intent. He's not suing for that. In other words, we're only here at this stage with damages for two things. One, the assignment to the metal detectors. He was given mental anguish damages of $300,000 for that. The other, passed over for chief deputy, he was given $300,000 for that. Those are really the only two adverse employment consequences.
Okay, let me ask you that. So that you have some evidence of, you argue you're lucky to have a job, as being some evidence, I guess, that whoever assigned him to the security had malice.
Right.
I mean, you have to have some.
Okay. Did not have malice, but acted as the
conduit for malice.
Yes. Acted as the conduit for malice. Correct.
Okay. Now, does that work? Is that the same evidence that you rely on for some evidence of the conduit for malice 3 years later?
Different evidence.
Okay. What evidence is for that one?
Okay. Let's talk about the 3 years later is funny, Auburn. And let me place this in context, because I think it's critically important if the court will indulge me. Here's the context. Paniagua is a department director. Davis, the retaliatory actor, is a department director. There are no higher positions in the city before you get to the city manager's office. Zimlich is in Paniagua's department, is on loan to this other department. And while he's there, he accuses the department director, the highest level person, of illegal acts. He does it in the most public way possible. It's on the news. It's all over the city. It is so bad that the city council, questioning Davis's judgment, asks for a response. The response is provided by Davis, whose arm is up to his armpit in the cookie jar, because why? He ordered 356 tons of solid waste to be buried next to a stream, violation of environmental laws, and remarkably, did it in a lower-income minority neighborhood, which is a political bombshell. To cover himself, remarkably, the city manager's office lets him write the report. It's a complete whitewash. Now, what they want us to believe, what they want us to believe is that Paniagua is completely ignorant of all this. She doesn't know about it. She hasn't seen it, and it's because there's no direct evidence that she read the report or seen the TV thing, which tantamount to asking us to believe that someone in the Nixon cabinet never heard of Watergate, or somebody in the Clinton cabinet never heard of Whitewater. Now, but even if we assume that legal fiction, she doesn't know as a result of that, they can't get around this evidence. Donahoe testified on direct, pulled out by the city, what did you do in the wake of this event? He says, I talked to four people. I talked to Zimlich, who laid it all out for me. Unvarnished, these people are halting my investigation. He turns around then to talk to the targets, Davis and Mendoza. What do they tell him? There's nothing to it. There's not a thing. We're taking care of it. It's being remedied. And he talks then, finally, after he continues to get reports of Zimlich, and this is dragged out by the city. This is their direct case. It's their theory that Davis has done nothing wrong, to Paniagua. Now, the jury is entitled to infer in that situation that what Donahoe is telling Paniagua is no different than what Donahoe is telling the jury.
Davis is the one with malice. Donahoe is not the one with malice. So the question is, what's the evidence on...
Okay. And let me make this clear. When we're talking about conduit, it doesn't matter whether Donahoe has malice. Let me give you an analogy. A nurse overdoses a patient with...
The evidence Paniagua demoted the chief deputy because of Donahoe's report to her 3 years earlier.
Mind you now.
I may be getting confused. The issue, it seems to me, is Davis had malice.
was Donahoe a conduit for Davis's malice in the temporary assignment of security?
Yes.
And you're arguing that there is evidence that he was a conduit because he said you're lucky to have a job.
And about eight other things.
Well.
That have all been recognized by the Fifth Circuit as being sufficient. Yes.
On that
assignment. On that assignment.
Security assignment. Now, on Paniagua, you're arguing, well, because Donahoe reported to Paniagua, Paniagua now is a conduit for Davis. But I mean, it seems to me the concession here is that Donahoe had no malice. And so you have to demonstrate that Paniagua acted on some report that Davis initiated.
Correct.
And, well, and how does that work?
Let me tell you why it doesn't matter if Donahoe had malice. Let me just draw it down here.
I may not be clear. If Paniagua operated on a report from Davis,
right,
that would be the theory.
That
but your argument is
Donahoe.
That's right. But your point is, you say your evidence is not a report of Davis to Paniagua through Donahoe. Your argument is that Donahoe reported to both Davis and to Paniagua, and so there's some sort of conduit. And I'm sorry.
I understand. No, I am saying that Donahoe did act as a conduit from Davis to Donahoe acted as a conduit from Davis to Paniagua. Donahoe did. In other words, what I am saying is that the account that Donahoe is given to Paniagua, the jury could find to be more probable than not, is exactly the same account that he is given to the jury. Okay? In other words, and it only makes sense. In other words, he's reporting to, you know, it's not too hard to connect the dots in this situation. He talks to Paniagua and says, well, what did Zimlet say? What did Davis say? Who do you believe? Now, why is that a reasonable inference? I mean, once again, we're back to the circumstantial case. Look at the Azzaro decision by the in-bank Third Circuit. It says that in situations like that, close personal advisor, there's some inferences that the jury can draw. In this case, it would be absurd. I mean, what other story could Paniagua be fed? And once you buy into Davis's theory, and this is the key, and again, this is the theory that they carried through the trial of this case, you have Zimlick is not just insubordinate. The man is a loose cannon off the charts insubordinate. He has just disobeyed a direct order by a high-level city director who has 300 employees who told him, we've got it under control, drop this. And then he's gone and reported illegal activity.
But
who in that situation is going to report? Now, there's another piece of evidence you need to connect.
Why is it just as reasonable that Paniagua would have listened to Donahoe and said, well, I think that's a bunch of crap?
I'll tell you why it's not just as reasonable.
Because nothing happened for 3 years.
Okay. I'll tell you why. It's just as reasonable to say that Paniagua would say, that's a bunch of crap, because no one ever did. The city manager's office was given that opportunity. This is important for Shigeri causation. They could have been the non-conduit, severed the causal link. They could have and should have just gone to their partner in this deal, the TNRCC, who would have said clearly, Davis is in the wrong, Zimlick is in the right. They didn't do it. So what possible reason would Paniagua have to say, you know, I understand that you, Donahoe, believe, and this is what he's saying, I believe Davis is right, Zimlick is wrong. I hear that from you. And I'm now looking at the city manager report, which adopts Davis' view. But, you know, independently, I think that's a bunch of crap. That would be the most ridiculous inference that anyone could possibly draw, because no one within the city upper management ever even suggested that Davis was wrong. But you know what? He was. And it was established conclusively at trial.
His conduct
was illegal.
Let me ask you about the way the case was tried. You said earlier that the earnings were for not getting elevated to chief deputy, and the mental anguish was for the metal detector assignment. But that's the question covers just any discrimination. The damages are awarded for any discrimination.
That's right.
but did the evidence link these to one or the other, or is it going to be the case that if you ask for damages because you were not made senior deputy by Donahoe, and we don't think that's there's any evidence to support that discrimination, or that there's any evidence to support any one of the other elements.
I understand.
What does that do to your damage?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. Of course, we started off with a standard. We believe there's evidence of all of this. But to directly answer your question, it's quite clear if you look at the evidence. First off, we know that the $300,000 for the loss of earnings is clearly tied to the chief deputy position. I mean, there's no evidence of any loss of pay with respect to the assignment to the metal detectors. Now, with respect to the mental anguish, all of the evidence that was put on with respect to the mental anguish mattered went to the metal detectors. In other words, the testimony was in the wake of that assignment, when Zimlich saw his promising career basically going in the tank, he saw the psychologist, the psychiatrist took the medication. So all of the evidence with respect to mental anguish of a type, and it does pass muster under, you know, I always forget the case names, but, you know, right.
Parkway.
Or Gunn, or the one I was up here. Yes. That is clearly tied to that. So if it was a matter of, you know, do we render or remand, I mean, that's how it parses out.
Can you say just a word about the punitive damage award?
Yeah, I can. One of the arguments that's being made under the punitive damages award and is that how can we do that here when he was not terminated, something, you know, really, really bad, he was simply, you know, transferred, demoted, things of that type. The answer to that question is in the Forsyth case. That was a case in, you know, the Edith Jones decision in which there was no loss of pay, there was no termination, there was simply a punitive assignment. Actuals 125, puny 750. The reason for that is that the act, the punitive statute, which is now gone, I mean, it was eliminated in 95, was enacted to address a public concern, not a private one. In other words, that what we are directing the punitives at is discouraging the type of conduct that Davis engaged in, and ultimately the city manager's office, who blindly embraced him without independently investigating. It's not a matter of looking and saying, do we think he was really hurt badly or not? And in this case...
So there's no difference between actual damages and punitive damages?
No, there absolutely is. No. And I don't want to be heard to be
saying
that.
Okay,
I understand. No. Now, in terms of measuring it, there's another subtle point here. And they talk about the Continental Coffee case, and this is technical, but let me make it. The case was submitted not as a pure Continental Coffee matter. Look at the Osterberg decision that Judge Abbott authored recently, who says when we measure the sufficiency of the evidence, we do it under the charge that was submitted without objection. That's exactly what was happening here. Now, the Court of Appeals was very good about saying, look, I don't care if you do it under the charge as submitted under Continental Coffee, it fits. And I'm telling you, it fits in spades. This is a fellow, Davis, once again, who has done incredible things by ordering 356 tons of solid waste to be buried when he's got no authority to do it in a minority neighborhood. It's remarkable conduct. And then, to cover himself up, he slams this man because it's a case where for Davis to be right, Zimlich has to be wrong, and by God, he was wrong. And everybody believed it because Davis said it, and he wrote the friggin' report to, you know, the city council. Everybody signed off on it. That's punitive.
Would you, in the event you favor us with any further writing, would you address the, and I'm not asking you to do this now. The last part of the school board's amicus brief, where they go through a number of factors and try to apply them to the facts.
And I might do follow up. Let me say this. The school board amicus brief is an outstanding brief. It's written by Barry Abrams, an outstanding lawyer, and I agree with about 98% of them. He gives a bunch of hypotheticals. I mean, let me just say that. You know, remember he clicks off those hypotheticals? The answer should be yes, the answer should be no. I'm going down to read and go, yes, yes, no, no, yes, no. I mean, there's very little I disagree with. Let me tell you a point to disagree. I don't read the Court of Appeals opinion as establishing the collective entity theory of liability as he articulates it. Now, Barry Abrams is a brilliant lawyer. He reads it that way. And one of the things, I mean, it is worth granting review, if for no other reason, for this court to make clear, we agree with Abrams. That's not the law. I mean, I don't know how to make it any more clearly, it's not the law. So that's about the only place where I part company with it. Every one of the hypotheticals, I think, about, you know, what should happen to school boards, I agree with. Shouldn't. It's just a matter that, like all of us, unfortunately, who write amicus briefs, we depend on the people who kind of got us involved. And their factual recitation, I'm sorry to say, is simply skewed. Okay, so that's what it is. The legal arguments are brilliant, and I think correct.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Let me ask you, I've had an opportunity to look back to the reference of Simlick being badge heavy. That was a statement made about him in the first evaluation after the Peters incident. What evidence, other than from the Peters incident, was there to indicate that Simlick was badge heavy?
Your Honor, the statement badge heavy never appeared in an evaluation. That was a statement made by Mr. Alexander in his brief to the Court of Appeals, and unfortunately the Court of Appeals accepted that without actually looking at the evaluation. The evaluation concluded as an exhibit to our brief, and you know, the court can look at it and see for itself. That had never appeared in the interpretation.
What, from what was it interpreted?
It's the statement that Doug Alexander made in his brief.
But what was he interpreting to make that statement?
I think he was...
badge happy? I mean, but was there something close?
Are you asking what... I think he was interpreting what he thought the animus in the city was towards him, what they thought that he was...
So when the Court of Appeals quotes that was in the report, that's just simply not true.
That's right. It's not true. Your Honor, all the evidence that they show proves, at most, knowledge. It proves that Paniagua and Donahoe knew about the whistleblower report. Knowledge is not enough to show retaliation or malice. If it were, then all a whistleblower would have to do to get life tenure is make sure everybody knew about his whistleblower report. Get on the news. Send a memo to every new supervisor you get saying, for your information, I blew the whistle.
But you've seen the school board's amicus, and why? And if that's not enough, why isn't evidence that someone with inferior qualifications was elevated and you weren't? Why isn't that some more evidence to show discriminatory intent?
I think that if Zimlick had shown that he was the most qualified person for the job, that would be evidence.
Job of chief deputy.
That's right. He did not show that. And there is no evidence in the record as to Paniagua's motive. That was Zimlick's burden, and he did not show it. He didn't even call her to testify. Therefore, and Your Honor, even if this court finds that Donahoe did retaliate, there's absolutely no evidence that he acted with malice. That is a separate question, and there's no evidence that Donahoe acted with criminal intent required for malice. Even more so, there is no evidence with regard to Paniagua that she retaliated or that she acted.
I mean, going back for just a minute to the promotion question, the evidence, then are you saying again that what the Court of Appeals recited as being in the record about Zimlick's qualifications and about the qualifications of the person who was ultimately chosen for the job, that is not an accurate statement of evidence from the record?
The only statement in the record about the promotion is that one of Zimlick's fellow deputies made a conclusory statement that Zimlick was the best qualified person. He didn't introduce any evidence of his education or anything that made him qualified. And there are many reasons
why... Is it not in the evidence that the person ultimately selected did not possess the basic qualifications or that the marshal's office had to waive requirements for him to apply?
That's in the evidence.
That is in the evidence?
Yes. And there are many reasons why an employer chooses to promote someone over someone else. Now, if this court wants to superimpose itself into the employer, I would say that would be impermissible. the key thing here is what was Paniagua's intent when she passed Zimlet over for promotion. No one ever asked her. No one ever asked anyone else.
Are you contending that you would have to have direct evidence of that in order to support liability?
No, Your Honor, I'm not. But there isn't any circumstantial evidence as to Paniagua's intent. All it can be shown is that she knew about the report, never that she acted on it. About Donahoe, even though all those other questions have to be answered, about Donahoe's retaliation, the standard, no evidence review, has to be conducted within a substantive standard. And a substantive standard requires the plaintiff to disprove the plaintiff's legitimate, I'm sorry, the defendant's legitimate reason for the action. And regarding the metal detectors, the city's legitimate reason was the reorganization of the marshal's office. All the evidence that Zimlet cited, none of it suggests that that reason was false.
Therefore, what about the response when Mr. Zimlet asked him the question, why am I on metal detectors? And he said, well, you're lucky to have a job after the Peters incident.
Your Honor, although that might raise a prima facie evidence of retaliation, once the employer gives it legitimate reasons, the plaintiff must disprove it. That is what Hines says. Hines says that the plaintiff has to
prove that Mr. Donahue didn't say it or did.
No, sir. Prove that the legitimate reason that Donahoe gave for the reorganization of the marshal's office was not true, and there's no evidence for that.
Well, what about what Mr. Alexander has cited from the record about the way the examination and the cross-examination went with respect to the explanation offered by Mr. Donahoe? Is that accurately reflect the record, and would that be enough?
I'm sorry, I don't recall exactly.
As I recall, Mr. Alexander talked about the fact that there was some question about a child custody matter and whether or not he could conform because he was having difficulty as a result of that. And then on cross-examination, he was shown records from the court or something that indicated that the matter had been concluded for 2 years. Would not that meet the burden that you just described?
No, Your Honor, because none of that goes to the issue of whether the marshal's office was in fact being reorganized and whether they were re-evaluating the courthouse security position and making it a permanent position that would be filled permanently by deputy marshals and no longer by rookies or retirees. There's nothing to disprove that.
So the city gave more than one reason then?
Yes.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience will be